He told me about his 10 gig transceiver. His 10 gigahertz transmitter is mounted behind a 2-foot dish on the top of his 170-foot Rhone 55 tower. So his total feed line to that 10 gig dish is 200 feet long. Let me drop. And if that was 200 feet of waveguide, he would have 10 dB of loss. It would be hard to live with it, even if it's mil-spec waveguide, silver-plated, with dry nitrogen fill. He's got his down converter for 10 gigahertz mounted in a box, a weatherproof box, behind the dish. So the typical tunable IF system, he's feeding 144 megacycles up the cable to the box. The box converts 144 meg sideband to 10 gigs. The so-called tunable IF down converter approach. But what's unique about his approach, I did that also, is that he doesn't have a power cable to bring up the 12 volts and the command to transmit the relay on and off. He does everything on the one piece of hardline cable. So one piece of hardline cable, the 12 volts or the 14 volts is on the center conductor. He's got a breakout box up top, which sends the DC over to the power supply where it gets regulated locally. The 144 megs goes to the transverter, and he also turns on and off a 12 megacycle signal, which gets detected up there, and as it gets detected, that's the command that sends the relay into the transmit mode versus the receive mode. So one piece of cable does commanding, signaling, and B-plus conversion. He leaves the B-plus on all the time so that the brick oscillator assembly is always drawing current. The heat that does in the box dries out the box. There's a small weep hole in the bottom, and it's operated for him for 10 years with no reliability problems. So the bottom line of all this is great VHF communication is going on these days below channel 6. Your 50 to 80 megacycle region is getting some very nice propagation. So which days of the week were you seeing this? Was this on Monday and Tuesday, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W,
W-2-C-H.
C-H recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, it was this past week. It was the week before I called you. It was that Monday, that Wednesday, and I think Thursday. It was like about, say, a week ago from this past Monday was the first night I was seeing it. Basically, it seemed to be something like early June. It was like the first week of June, when I recall. That week, during that week, I was getting this kind of reception.
And this is the ideal time of year. Late May, early June is when you get a real big peak of long-range propagation on VHF frequencies, sporadic E, and all these other modes of operation, the so-called magic band, six-meter band. If you're a six-meter operator, this is the time when you really enjoy it. In fact, the microwave reflector had a whole lot of guys all complaining about the exact same thing in the June contest, and that is 6 meters during the June contest last weekend was so darn open that it sucked up everybody. And the serious guys on 2 meters, 432 and 1296, had nobody to talk to. Everybody was down on 6 meters, working brand new states, brand new countries, brand new DX and whatever. It was a magnet that sucked everybody away. And so they're in the talking phase of saying that the June contest should be broken up into two separate contests. Let me drop. One contest that's strictly 6 meters, and the other contest is above 2 meters. There are people complaining about the fact that the normal VHF operation on the higher frequencies that they look forward to in the June contest didn't happen because of the 6 meters. So here you have a tremendous number of ham radio operators complaining about the fact that they were getting too many good band openings down on 6 meters. Funny picture, as you can tell. I'll see what Ray's got to say. Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel, K2RIW. Go ahead, Ray.
Yes, good evening, Dick, and Annette, WTCH, Ray here. I want to comment two things. Yes, during the contest last weekend, on Saturday in the evening, and then again Sunday morning, and all of the evening, I even missed listening to Annette, stayed on 6, was open right to the end of the contest. Mostly it was to the west all the time, even up into Canada, up into Quebec was a bit of northeast, but Out west, I did work NK7U out in Baker, Oregon with a ham stick. That was 2,200 miles in the evening. And like you said, 2 and 432 were pretty quiet from that, and didn't have too many on those bands. So I thought I'd comment how good that was. And also about the Canadian going digital, which did after us. I believe in some markets, some stations did not yet go digital from what I've read in an article. I can't remember exactly where. Might have been monitoring time. K2RIW, W2CH.
Very fine, Ray. A ham stick antenna talking to Oregon, 2,200 miles. Wow. I thought Barry was doing it last weekend because he's using this 52-foot-long boom Yagi, but he did say that the Yagi wasn't required. What's really happening here is that when Mother Nature opens the band and you get this sporadic E-cloud, which acts, it acts like a sheet of metal at, let me pick a number, 60,000 feet, no, 60 nautical miles. 60 miles up, you get this sheet of metal. The sporadic E-cloud is so highly ionized, it has the reflectivity of a sheet of metal, a few miles square, and you reflect a signal off of that at 60 miles up, and boy, you get strong signals. When Mother Nature gives you that propagating condition, the signal that normally would get there by forward propagated tropospheric scatter, that means slight atmospheric inhomogeneities, give you a little bit of weak signal scattering, and along comes the sporadic E-cloud, she can easily make the signal 80 or 100 decibels stronger. Let's see now, each S unit is 6 dB, so we're talking about 15 S units of equivalent of extra strength. US meter is not calibrated that way, if you know what I mean. But you go from a signal that is below threshold, where with the volume up full blast, you can barely tell something is there, to Mother Nature gives you this band opening, and now you're pegging the needle 60 dB over S9. You get the... There are guys who think they're going to operate much more DX. Let me drop this. Because they've increased the gain of their antenna, they've increased the altitude of the antenna, or they've increased the power output of the transmitter. You start going to real high power of a transmitter, you could easily go up 10 to 1 in power. You go to a higher gain antenna, and you can go 10 to 1 increase in antenna gain. You go extra altitude on the antenna, and you can get the equivalent of a 2 to 1 power increase, so to speak. You add those all together, and it doesn't come close to 100 decibels of signal strength increase because of what Mother Nature does. 100 dB is a 10 billion to 1 apparent power ratio. So Mother Nature dominates. So when the 20-meter band is closed, unless you've got one humongous setup, you're not going to open it, if you know what I mean. Some people don't realize that Mother Nature is a lot stronger than what you can do. Without a doubt, when you've got marginal conditions, those extra gain of your transmitter, your antenna, and the altitude is going to put you above the crowd, and you're going to make it in the pileup, if you know what I mean. So it's still worth doing it, but it's not the be-all, end-all compared to what Mother Nature can do. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. Let me double-check that I haven't skipped over anybody that did sign in. K2LIW listening.
N2ZEA.
N2ZEA. I'm not sure whether or not you did sign in or not, and maybe I'm just... Go right ahead. Give me your name, and you go ahead with your question. ZEA, RIW.
Hey, Dave. A couple years back, I discussed the possibility of metering a high-velocity metallic projectile through two coils, one being energized with a DC current, the other being a sense coil, and we talked for length at the time. Been pondering the idea for a while, but I'm ready to start building the thing, and I'm curious to know how to construct these things, how many turns to make, and how much current to run through the energizing coil, and what kind of output to expect.
Okay, Glenn, you're going to have to refresh my memory. Are you speaking of a kind of a real gun? The words you've used makes it sound like you'd like to build a real gun. And if that's what it is, we've got a guy on frequency, John, who's been doing some real good work on that exact subject recently, KC2WGB. So refresh my memory, Glenn. Is it a real gun you're trying to build? N2ZEA, K2RIW.
No, it's not actually a gun. We're going to use a real gun. I want to meter the projectile. I don't want to measure whether it made it through the middle of the two coils or not. And I just want to energize one with a DC current and the other with a sense coil, and then look for a pulse.
Okay. Now I'm beginning to think that you're trying to build a very high-speed proximity detector. In other words, as the projectile goes from coil number one to coil number two, coil number one is going to be giving you a steady state current, magnetic field, and as the projectile goes through it and enters coil number two as the detector, you want to know the exact microsecond, so to speak, that the projectile is going through the second coil. Is that approximately what you're looking for, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, kind of, but the two coils are going to be coaxial, just against each other, no distance between them. And I just want to measure whether or not the projectile went through the middle of them or not. So how do I start building these things, and what kind of current do I run through one of them?
There's a slim chance that you can do this all with one coil, Glenn. With one coil of wire being used as a resonator, as an inductor, sensor, there's all kinds of ways you can do it. But let's assume that the coil is part of a variable frequency oscillator. There's a capacitor somewhere else that determines the resonant frequency. And then you, by taking your projectile, suspend it on a plastic rod, and you put the projectile in the middle of that coil. The presence of the projectile will change the inductance of the coil. So the one single coil with some kind of excitation, it could be DC, it could be AC, it could be RF, there's various ways you can excite the coil so that you're sensitive to its inductance. And the presence of the metallic object in the middle of that coil will definitely change the inductance. And with the right kind of a circuit, you can sense the change of inductance, and your circuit will say, aha, that projectile just arrived during this microsecond. I'm not sure you need two coils to do it. You may get more sensitivity out of two coils, but I think there's a possibility of one coil. But just simply the change in inductance by the presence of the metallic object is one way of detecting it. Now, you and I are here. Let me drop
this. This is DCZ.
Hal recognized, and I'm going to go over to Hal in a second. You and I are sitting here reinventing the wheel, Glenn. This is a classic problem, and I think there's a 50-50 chance Hal's going to tell us he's already done it, and the so-and-so manufacturer already makes the detector, and just go out and buy it. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
2RIW, detector, K6DPZ. He could do it with capacitance also. The projectile pass through two different capacitive rings, and that change the pulse capacitance we measured the time.
Another good suggestion. So, capacitance between the two rings, inductance change of one single coil, inductance change of one coil being the excitation, and over top of it is another coil, or inside of it is another coil that's acting as the detector. There's lots of ways of doing this. Before you start the actual experiment, I recommend you do a data search, an archival search. This is a classic problem. Lots of people have in the past used lasers and other kinds of very high-speed optical devices to illuminate a projectile as it hits a particular target. As the bullet hits a balloon and it's starting to burst, or hits a glass and the glass is just starting to burst, or it's starting to go through an apple or a banana or whatever, lots and lots of people have built very fast detectors to do very high-speed photography. And however they've done it, they've been there, they've done it, they've pulled their hair out, they've solved the problem, if you know what I mean. And so for you to start off and start reinventing this wheel, I recommend you do a data search first before you do that. Because
muzzle velocity measurement stick.
Go ahead, tell us about that, John. You're a ordnance man from way back, so how would you do it? Wait for the beeps, and you got it, John.
Yes, Dick, there's also a machine that's manufactured. I forget the name of it. I believe it starts with an O, something like odometer. And you fire the weapon between those two rings, and it'll give you an exact muzzle velocity. So if he Googles muzzle velocity measurements, he's going to get a ton of information.
So as you can see, Glenn, my first suggestion is you do some research on this, because it is a classic problem, and you don't want to spend the next 3 months of your life reinventing this particular wheel when someone's already done it, and it may be a commercial product, and maybe the commercial product has come down to a reasonable price. And are you doing this, Glenn, as a science experiment, or is there a definite need you've got for measuring the exact timing of a projectile? Sounds like a fun project. N2ZEA K2LIW.
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with the timing. It's just the presence. I'm trying to build some electronic targets, and I figured if I had 16 of them out on the range, and I could light the perimeters with some LEDs, and the target would only be active while the LEDs were lit, and then it would move to another one. It might be fun to try and engage them all. I'm not that good with electronics that I could do something with AC, with a resonant circuit or something like that. So I figured just looking for a pulse and just a simple two-transistor amplifier, I'm able to amplify the pulse enough to swap a flip-flop.
Yeah, let me get the picture of this one now. I think you're going to make a random function generator which lights up target. In other words, you light up light-emitting diodes at various positions at various periods of time across the target area, and now the competition is for the guy to shoot towards the particular lit area during the time it's lit and do it fast enough before that light goes out, the light goes on somewhere else, and now you've got to move the weapon. Is that approximately and you want to find out how close the guy gets to the lit bulb by way of electronic detection. Is that approximately what you're doing, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing, except that the targets can be, I guess, about a foot in diameter, and the LEDs are around the circumference of the coils. And if you can get it through the coils, then you score a point, and if it doesn't go through the coil, I'm assuming there's no pulse and it won't register.
Yeah, I think that's doable. I know it's doable. I didn't say it's easy, and I do recommend you do some research. So you're going to have large diameter coils, maybe a foot in diameter, so if the guy gets within that foot diameter of the ring of light-emitting diodes, so he's not aiming for the diodes, thank goodness. He's aiming for the ring in between, and hopefully the light-emitting diodes are easily replaceable item, because they're going to get hit. That sounds like a fun project. I don't have a great solution for you, but I think you better do some research on that one. We're going to go over to do the Mel's mailbag now. John, as you guys know, collects the emails and the snail mails from the guys who don't yet have their license, or for whatever reason they can't get on the net and talk to us directly. So what kind of mind-boggling questions did we get this week, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, we got some easy ones this week, Dick. This young gentleman wants to do something exactly like Mel did, and he needs your advice, because he has a 65-foot pine tree in his yard, which is about 70 feet from his shack, and he wants to run that green wire antenna, and he needs some help to know, does he have to mount that wire on standoffs away from the bark of the tree, and to feed it he's going to use RG58, but he wants to know, should he direct bury it, or should he take it through the air and then run it down the tree? And also, does he need a ground rod at the tree for the braid of the coax? Just some basic information so he can get something constructed. But it sounds like he's got a good tree for the project. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I wish I had a chance to see Mel's pine tree before he became a silent key. I believe the antenna was suspended from the top away from the vertical dipole, quasi-vertical dipole, suspended away from the tree with a piece of PVC tubing, so that the top of the dipole didn't come too close to the tree, so that he had the ability to run 100 watts, 500 watts without arcing over to the tree. If the top of the dipole is, let's say, an inch away from a branch, there's some chance that when you run high power, you arc over to the branch. The chances of catching the tree on fire are pretty low, but you want to be a little bit careful with that one. So he did suspend it away from the tree with an insulated material like PVC. You now have a number of choices. The direct forward approach would be to feed the dipole in the conventional manner in the center, run the coax cable away from the dipole at right angles over to the tree, bind it to the tree, run it down the tree and into the shack. That's one approach. And hopefully use a balancing device right where you connect the coax cable to the dipole. Let me drop. That would work, and that's a conventional way of feeding the dipole. But once you study the electronics of a dipole, you realize that if you're smart enough, there is nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. The dipole itself is like a flywheel. It's an electronic flywheel. You're storing energy in it and cycling that energy back and forth, just like a flywheel rotates, and you push with a push rod, so to speak, on the steam engine, if you know what I mean, to turn the flywheel. So you can load energy into the dipole by feeding it in the center, feeding it one quarter of the way, one half of the way away from the center, or the outer edge. The most mechanically convenient technique would be to feed the outer the edge of the dipole, the bottom tip of the dipole, where it comes close to the ground, would be the most convenient way to feed it. And you'll get the exact same performance out of the dipole. And you don't put a center insulator in that case. It's just one continuous piece of wire. So you can feed it down there, and it'll work like a charm. There's one catch, and that is when you feed the outer edge of the dipole, or as you move away from the center, the apparent impedance increases. It's roughly a 70 ohm impedance when you feed it in the center. Maybe it's a 200 ohm impedance when you feed it halfway toward the outside. And when you feed the outer edge, it's a 1500 ohm impedance. Let me drop. The 1500 ohm impedance has got some very good news and not so good news. The very good news is that when you're feeding an impedance that's that high, the chintziest little ground rod at that point to connect the shield to will be more than enough ground because you're feeding a very high impedance, 1,500 ohms. I mean, ordinarily, you'd like a ground rod to have 2 ohms to the universe, if you know what I mean. In this particular case, if the ground rod had 100 ohms of extra ground rod resistance, you wouldn't even know it because you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance and you're pushing against a 100 ohm resistance, if you know what I mean. It's essentially a short circuit. That's the good news. The bad news is that now you need some kind of an impedance step-up device. In other words, you're 50 ohms coming out of the cable. You want to set it up, step it up to something like 1,500 ohms before you connect it to the tip of the dipole. That could be a very simple step-up transformer. A couple of turns of wire as a resonator, and you tap it a certain number of turns from ground. You tap it at the 50 ohm turn point, where the top of it is 1,500 ohms. That's the, if you took apart the base of a mag mount antenna, that's a 5/8 wave, you'll find a circuit just like that inside. It literally is a flat coil, and the 50 ohm coax is a one turn up on that multi-turn coil. Or you could also do it with an LC network, the right value of capacitor and inductor. Let me drop. We're coming out of a coax cable. You've got a series capacitor, a capacitor in series with an inductor, and the inductor goes to ground. The junction between the two is the high impedance point, 1,500 ohm point, that goes to the dipole. So by choosing the right inductor and the right capacitor, you'll be resonating it at your frequency of your antenna and stepping up the impedance all in one step. That's a LC impedance matching network. And you Google those words and you'll find some nice articles on it, on how to do that, impedance matching with two reactors, an inductor and a capacitor. So the vertical dipole in the tree, properly done, will give you very high performance, very inexpensive materials, and it's a very good experiment that'll teach you how much better a vertical dipole is and the fact you don't have to feed it in the center if you don't want to. If you have trouble understanding the theory of operation and you want to feed it in the center with the coax cable coming off to one side, going over to the tree, that's okay. But you don't have to go through that rigmarole. It could be all one simple one point of suspension, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech band.
KC2PZ, you could develop a Pi network with a step-up impedance device.
Yeah, the Pi is doing it with three components. As long as you're not trying to tune to multiple frequencies, two components will do it, Hal, believe it or not. But yes, Hal's absolutely right. The right kind of a Pi network, CLC, choose the right values and you can match essentially any impedance to any other impedance. You take apart most of the antenna tuners that we buy. It's a great big Pi network inside of that box, which can match almost anything. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, good enough. I think Bob is going to have a lot of fun with that. And it's definitely doable. And if he wants to, he could probably run some PVC pipe underground to pull his RG-58 if it isn't direct burial and do exactly what you said, make the connection at the bottom. He won't have to go up in the tree except to mount the offset for the top of the antenna. I think that'll work well for him. Let me let drop one on to the second one.
Yeah, the running RG-58 cable through PVC pipe underground is one approach. The other approach is to go directly with hardline. The 70-ohm hardline is used for cable television. Believe it or not, is made for direct burial. So if that was the feed line, he doesn't have to go through the rigmarole of running it through, snake it through a piece of PVC pipe. The hardline itself can be directly buried, and the possibility exists that the outer shield of the hardline going through the earth is enough of a ground that when you put the semiconductor through the impedance matching network into the antenna, that would work without a ground rod. Now, put in the ground rod to be belt and suspended, but there's a slim chance it would operate without the ground rod at all when you directly bury the coax. Back to you, John, K2LIW.
This is DTZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, if he's running a half-wave device, he doesn't even need a ground rod because he's driving it at the end. It's half-wave. That's all counterpoise.
The whole reason why, when it's a half-wave antenna set at the outer end, that you don't need anywhere near as much of a counterpoise is because you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. Very similar to if you built a ground plane antenna, a normal vertical ground plane antenna. If you're smart enough to select a resonator, the radiator, that's a half wavelength long electronically instead of a quarter wave, now you don't need 32 ground plane radios. Three of them is more than enough. Maybe two of them would work. And the whole reason for that is the outer edge of a dipole is roughly a 1,500 ohm impedance. When you're feeding 1,500 ohms, maybe your body capacitance would be enough of counterpoise, if you know what I mean. You're just holding on to the coax cable. I'm not recommending you do that, but I'm just telling you what might work. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
That's a great idea, Dick, because the length of cable he needs, he might be able to get free at a cable company if he just checks that out. So, yeah, direct burial saves all the trouble of putting that pipe in the ground, which I hate doing myself. So I'm sure he'll have fun with that. All right, I'll go on to the next one. You let it drop. All right, I have a question here from Mark R. He did not tell me where he's located, but he had a good question. What he's wondering is, when you have an antenna up and you have this tremendous amount of RF information coming into this antenna, is it possible that you could have a device to record all of that RF information and play it back at a later time and then use your receiver to select the individual signals you want to listen to? If so, how? And if not, why? Back to you, Dick, KC2W2B.
Absolutely. Believe it or not, this is close to what's going on with the most modern SETI search radio telescope type thing. If you're smart enough to build the antenna so that the antenna itself is broadband, you don't have to, but you get the best performance if the antenna... Let's assume now that I really care about what's happening between 500 and 1,000 megacycles, for instance. And if I'm smart enough to build a log periodic or some other kind of antenna that's got a real good impedance match and constant gain from 500 or 1,000 megs, that's a very good beginning. Now, there are kinds of very high-speed, very broadband recording devices to make it 500 megs wide. I'll admit that's pushing the state of the art. However, what they do with a SETI search receiver is they have a whole bunch of individual receivers. In other words, if I had receiver number one that covers 500 to 510, receiver number two covers 510 to 520, and so on, and I've got them all running in parallel, at first it would sound like it would fill up a room with hardware. With modern-day integrated circuits, each one of those receivers is one particular phase-lock loop type integrated circuit chip, if you know what I mean. So If you're willing to devote enough hardware, you can definitely build individual receivers. There are ways of making a receiver probably at least 50 megacycles wide, so one single receiver could record 50 megacycles worth. Whatever your recording medium is going to be, if it was tape on tape, if it was on we may have to wait until this guy goes by. If it was tape, I'll admit you're going to chew up a whole lot of tape in a hurry. There are solid-state recording devices. Well, your disk drive these days, some of the really fast disk drives, could record an awful lot of data. Recording all the data is a bit of a pain. But once you've got all of these recordings, could you play it back and tune through it at a later time? Absolutely. The slight catch now is that you want to know what is the number of bits of depth. And I'll explain what I mean by depth. That mobile station is S4 at my QTH. The number of decibels, the number of bits. The number of bits of recording depth is something you've got to worry about. This is the best of all worlds. I'd like to be using a analog to digital converter with 14 bits. Now, 14 bits of resolution would give you a very nice signal-to-noise ratio. If I was only using a much less expensive analog-to-digital converter to do the recording, which only had, let's say, 4 or 5 bits, for strong signals that I'm listening on that band, no problem. For weak signals in the noise, getting a little bit weaker down to about S2 at my QTH right now. So if I only recorded with 6 bits, I would now be able to listen to strong. But after 6 bits, I'd be able to So for a weaker signal, a smaller number of bits of recording, the good news is you don't chew up your recording medium as fast. The bad news is when you want to play it back later on, the weaker signal will give you what's called digitizing noise, if you know what I mean. So there's a number of trade-offs here as to how many channels, how closely are spaced the channels, how many megacycles of bandwidth each one of the channels are, in other words, the number of bits of depth of recording. But without a doubt, the system you're describing, John, or that Mr. Mark R. is describing, has been built, and it's been it's what's being used right now for SETI search for extraterrestrial intelligence. At my QTH, and he is located within 2 miles of the repeater. So, the number of dBs of decibels of recording. How deep is your recording in digits of... Looks like we're back in operation. Okay. station is within 1 mile of the repeater, S3 at my location.
Right there. He's so strong, I could reach him. I want him to continue because I need that signal.
So, you've got a trade-off of how many bits of information, how fast you fill up your recording medium, how many channels go into the receiver. John, there already are systems like that. Not very many. They're kind of elaborate, kind of expensive, but it can be done. And they do fill up a lot of recording medium in a hurry. If you record to enough depth of enough bits of information, but then you can play them back at a later time and decide which portion of the frequency region you want to listen to, and look and dig for weak signals. That's been done. But to really dig the very weak signal out of that recording, you have to have a lot of bits of analog to digital converter to record in enough depth, if you know what I mean. Because it's a little bit like trying to find out the average height of the students in a classroom. If I was using a yardstick, S4 at my QTH, and again within a mile or so of the repeater. If I was only using a yardstick and using the intermediate numbers on it and trying to measure people's altitude, I'd be getting a very coarse answer. And you could say that that yardstick is the equivalent of using very few bits of analog to digital conversion. And as I start using the finer gradations on the yardstick, it's like using more bits in the analog to digital converter. KC2WGB, I think you were saying that you were not hearing the sound at your location. Is that true, John? KC2WGB? K2LIW?
No, Dick, he was...
He's getting weaker.
Well, the space report, but always a pleasure. KC2WGB. That's it from Mel's Corner. Back to you, Dick.
What did you say, Barry? N2MB? K2RIW? on Thursday. We got you. I can tell the guy's not quite as close to the repeater now as he was earlier. Paul, and to WS2N, I'm trying to remember the name of the thing that was launched. The space probe that was launched this week has a 30 or 25 foot long boom, which does very hard X-ray focusing, and I think the number was 32,000 electron volts. It's a very hard X-ray, and in order to focus those requires a really fancy boom, and that machine was launched this week, and when it's set up, it's going to be taking brand new pictures of the black holes that are the center of all of the galaxies. All of a sudden, not remember the name of that particular space probe. So give a little bit of a delay and then come back with your space report, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW. What was that name you just gave me, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW. Worth a try. It looks like that might not do it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. Input, but not too well through the machine right now, Paul. What's the name of that spacecraft with the 30-foot long boom that does the focusing of X-rays? Over to you, Paul.
New Star.
RC2N repeater controller V5.2846. The time is 50 p.m. The time is 50 p.m. Ready. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. The time is 50 p.m.
And so Paul just told us that the spacecraft was New Star. That's the one that's got a 30-foot long boom to it, and it's got these concentric rings of reflecting material, sort of like an onion, as they call it. Many layers of an onion is the actual focusing device, and this thing gives you very hard X-ray photographs. The New Star. What in the world, Paul, was the reason why it was launched from an aircraft and not launched from the ground near Kwajalein? I am guessing that they used a launch mechanism that subjects it to a smaller number of G-forces during the launch in order not to disturb that delicate lens assembly. Is that possibly the explanation? WS2N, K2LIW.
Pegasus rocket launched from the Stargazer.
Five, not found.
Inside of one another. an onion would give you, you know, give you an idea that something was fierce. Down. Put a lot of coffee cans, you know, inside coffee cans inside one another. That's the way I don't know if we're going to get through this. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
We're going to have to delay the space report a little bit, Paul. I'm hearing Paul very well on the input, but you're only partially through the machine because of what's going on. So that this is launched by orbital of the new star. Paul was indicating that it's not really an onion. It is a whole bunch of coffee cans inside of each other. What's really going on is that it's a little bit similar to what you'll recognize when you walk up to a storefront window and you look at the window. If you look at the window at a grazing angle, your rear window is giving you a reflection at a grazing angle. Okay, looks like we're getting through this way. Pegasus did the launch, Orbital Sciences, and what's really going on here is that an X-ray will ordinarily, particularly these very hard X-rays that the new science, new star, is looking for. One of the ways of rating the hardness of the X-rays, the highness of their frequency, is their electron volts. Up till now, any of our X-ray satellites, like the one called Chandra, the Chandra satellite, is only measuring X-rays up to, I think it's 15 kilo electron volts. They want to be able to measure 28 kilo electron volts, I think is the number with this thing, and this new new star goes all the way up to 32 kilo electron volts. So we're going to be measuring much higher frequency X-rays than had ever been measured before. And so they have a much more penetration capability. You'll be able to look through the cloud of dust around those black holes that are in the center of the galaxy at these hard X-rays. That's the good news. The bad news is that an ordinary lens will not focus them. If you put an ordinary lens in front of these kind of X-rays, it'll just go plowing right through the lens as if the lens wasn't even there. And the way they made the lens is it looks like a whole bunch of coffee cans inside of each other. It uses the grazing angle phenomenon. In other words, you look at a storefront, ordinary piece of glass, at a grazing angle, and it acts like a mirror. And X-rays will do the same thing. You've got these whole bunch of precise coffee cans inside of each other. The X-rays are being hitting the coffee can surfaces at a very shallow angle. And as long as that array of coffee cans is 30 feet out in front of your detector, as I said, 30 feet out in front of the detector, it gives you this beautiful image. So we're going to be getting much harder X-rays, much higher frequencies, or much smaller wavelengths than we've ever done before. Paul, I am coming through the 975, so I think that's the way you want to do it. WS2N, K2RIW.
Very good. That's all quite incorrect.
That's working like a charm, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay. Another topic, Dick, was that China has launched a three-person crew, two men and one female, first female for China, to the beginning of what they are building as a space station. They have one component up there now. It's a module about 30 feet long, about 11 feet diameter, and they're going up to dock with the first docking mission with this thing. And so they're moving along. Their first launch of a person was back in 2003, so I wanted to bring that up. They did have a launch on the 16th, yesterday morning, and that launches from the China's northeastern coast, northwestern coast, northwestern coast. So you know, here we are, we're in the United States, we're not launching anybody right now, and here's China launching people, and Russia's launching people, so they've got to get their act together. It looks like it's going to be done with private companies in the beginning, and then eventually we'll get the Orion spacecraft up there. But that's going to be probably 2017, the earliest we drop it. Okay, and the other thing I want to bring up is the Grail. The Grail spacecraft is doing good. They're going on to an extended mission. Grail is the two spacecraft that will launch one rocket, and they're in orbit around the moon, and they've been flying at roughly about 30 miles high, and they've done all kinds of tests, the gravity tests and all, and that's their main mission. But now that their main mission is over, they go on to an extended mission that they get funded for, and they'll be going into a lower orbit, and they'll be orbiting very low, roughly around 14 miles. That's the lowest anything has really orbited around the moon. To give you an idea of Apollo, was up around 60. And here this thing has been half that distance. Now it's going to be half again. When it goes over some of the high mountains, the mountains will only be about 5 miles below them. So they have their names. They name these things. Ebb and flow. You know, they're maybe a couple, maybe 100 miles or so apart, and they measure the distance between them. Let me drop it, and they can tell from the pull of the gravity of the moon all the different mass concentrations that are involved in the moon, and they could find out different minerals and, you know, a lot about the interior of the moon that they really didn't know. You know, I mean, they knew a lot, but now they've multiplied that information probably by 100. So I want to bring that up as long as I got it. WS2N. The Expedition 31 crew will be coming back in the beginning of July. They're up at the ISS getting ready to come back right now. It's a 6-person crew, and then it'll go down to 3 and then right back up to 6 again. They stay up there roughly 4 to 5 to 6 months at a time. So they checked out their seats and all, you know. The seats are especially designed for them on the Soyuz spacecraft. So when they go up, the seats are a certain height. But when you float around in space for 4, 5, 6 months, your height changes. So they actually have to get in there, make sure they fit okay, and make adjustments if they have to. So they went through that normal check, and they'll be heading back. Last week, we talked about the NEMO project, the underwater project, and you had a question about what do the astronauts or aquanauts sound like? Let me drop. When they're speaking, so I finally did find an interview that just came out because they just started another mission down there. And you can hear this one guy talking, and it's perfectly normal. They don't sound like Donald Duck, so that helium idea, whatever they're doing, I still haven't figured out exactly the proportions of air that they are breathing down there. Or even I'm sure the pressures are equal to the depth. I think it's 60 feet or something. But they sound perfectly normal in a regular interview that was going on. So I thought I'd bring that up. And that's pretty much it, Dick. Don't have any other topics, but we're here for any questions or comments. Back to that WS2N.
Paul, I think you said that the NEMO project runs at roughly 2 atmospheric pressures, and that would give you roughly twice the density of air. As such, a man's voice would sound very low. If you mixed in just the right amount of helium, you could bring it back to normal.